Hello and welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito, here with you for episode 103 and my conversation with the publisher and founder of Tom Tom Magazine and the co-creator of the Hit Like a Girl series, Mindy Abovitz Monk. Let's get right to it. As has frequently been the case on this show, I'm meeting the guest for the first time during this interview. I learned about Mindy through her appearance on the At Percussion podcast a few months back and thought she'd be a great person to talk to. And I'm certain I was right. Mindy started Tom Tom Magazine nearly a decade ago, a daily online resource that also exists as a quarterly printed publication. Aside from being the co-creator of the Hit Like a Girl series, she has taken her art installation, The Oral History of Female Drummers, throughout the U.S. Recently, she has added the title of podcaster to her mantle, creating and running the show The Beat and the Pulse. She's very active in the business, creative, political, and social realms, and you'll hear all about it and more in this interview. We recorded our interview over Skype on July 23rd, 2018, and it begins right now. Mindy, tell me about the beginnings of Tom Tom Magazine and what got you to start it.
So the beginnings of the magazine, I would say, almost 10 years ago now, in 2009, I was just a rudimentary coder and building some websites for friends and like small jobs, and was really interested in SEO and the way that Google retrieved information. And I was searching female drummer and girl drummer, which is what I was and am. I had been drumming for like 8 years about at that point. And I felt like the search results on Google were really poor and vapid and incongruous with what I understood to be a very large and growing population of girls and women drummers, including myself and all my friends. And so I set out in 2009 to literally just, you know, begin to amass articles and imagery of real women and girls who play the drums. And I also at that point thought that there would, of course, already be a magazine for female drummers. And I thought if there wasn't one, I wanted to start it, but that there surely was one. So I was going to put it out into the world through this blog I started that I'm covering girl drummers. So if, you know, the real person that's covering girl drummers out there will find me and then I'll just work for them. Mm-hmm. But what ended up happening is no one else is doing it. And I became the source of all things female drummer related. So 2009, it was a blog. And then shortly thereafter, it was a real website, tomtommag.com. And about a year after that, we put our first issue into print, 2010. There was a Yahoo search result that said, can girls really play the drums? And then very quickly, it was a bunch of people kind of chatting about whether or not girls can play. And it actually was a legal conversation about which parts of the world was it illegal for girls to play drums. And then it moved into condescending notes about can girls even play. And then and search number two was something probably about Cindy Blackman. And search number three, play the drums. And then if you hit the image search results, it was three or four women in bikinis next to drum sets, and then Neil Peart, John Bonham, and like other guys. So this is like girl drummer, you know, you're searching girl drummers and you get just look like bikini clad women and next to drum sets and then guys who actually play the drums. And, you know, like I was 29 at the time and I knew probably personally, I knew about 400 female drummers, let's say, just from touring and teaching and being really active in the New York music scene. And in my mind, I was like, are we valid, though? Is this group of us valid? And of course, the answer is yes. But I happen, you know, some of the people I happen to know were in up and coming or very popular bands. And so my answer was, yes, we are valid. And so I started to interview those folks first. The people I knew who were popular. So I started to cover those drummers first, and then I, at the same time, emailed all of my heroes, like Evan Glennie and Susie Ibarra and Cindy Blackman, who I mentioned, Sheila E., and Kim Thompson, and I slowly got responses from the, like, you know, the big hitters in the industry, and simultaneously was covering these women that were not yet covered on the internet. And I tapped into something that not just I wanted, but a lot of other people wanted too, which was awesome.
When you're starting out, these first interviews, are they phone interviews? Are they print interviews? Are they email where you send them the questions and they respond? How are you handling that?
The first interview was Mindy Abovitz being interviewed by TomTom Magazine.
Okay.
So I emailed myself a set of questions that I myself wrote. Mm-hmm. And 3 days later, I opened the email and tried to, you know, divorce myself from reality. And, oh, wow, I got these questions. And I answered them and I posted it onto tomtommagazine.blogspot.com, which was built on WordPress, and our website is still built on WordPress today. I did the first interview with myself just to see if the questions were all right. And then from there, I sent those questions or some version of them to the next however many drummers. But really quickly on until today, I'm not a writer, I'm not a photographer, I'm not a designer. I am a manager. I love putting on events, I love speaking, I'm an activist. So my role in TomTom has almost always been pulling all the pieces together and not doing any individual piece. So while I did some interviews in the beginning, very quickly, I was phased out by real writers and real journalists, and I was the person who kind of knew everyone, was bringing everybody together, and making the business moves and building the strategy, which I still do.
In that first set of questions, did you say, "How dare you ask me that question"? Did you
yeah.
say that, or
"Hello, how insensitive"?
Yeah.
No, that would have been amazing and insightful. No, it was more literal back then. Like, how long have you been drumming for?
Right.
And then, I mean, that was like the beginning of how I treat the magazine today, where you just kind of hide behind your product and you say, we are working on a project, and often it would be me.
Mm-hmm.
So that was like kind of the first step in making this look much bigger than just me. And oftentimes it is just me, and more often it's me and an army of humans mm-hmm. making this happen.
Yeah.
So luckily that has transformed. But yeah, asking myself questions isn't like an uncommon thing.
Yeah.
In the media world. Or in the business world.
A friend of mine that I'd had on my own show had suggested that I say the credits and say produced by Pete Zambito. Edited by Pete Zambito. Like do all like just to give myself all of the roles that I actually do.
Hey.
As a joke, and then there are times I'm like, maybe I should really actually do that.
Yeah, maybe that's actually, I actually like that idea. People need some transparency, like, this is what's actually happening.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm with you on that. When you were kind of looking at the group of drummers that you were starting to interview, was this like a phone list? Was this an email list? Where I'm just thinking about how you ended up. Did you have like a phone? Did you have like a little planner? How were you? What was your resource for all of the material?
I had an Excel doc early on, and I have to say, probably past issue two, that Excel doc became overwhelming. Like I had been asked in interviews in the early days if I was going to run out of content. That is one of the few questions that did offend me along the way. The answer was always so overwhelmingly obvious to me. No, we can't run out of content if you know anything about journalism, and we won't run out of content because there's so many of us, you just don't know about us, right?
Right.
And that's been true of all these lists I've tried to keep and make. Our metric for who we cover these days is this very kind of intricate metric that's ideally a reflection of what's the media at large has been leaving out, which is people of different, you know, ages and races and body types, sexualities, gender permutations, ability levels, where they live in the world, their class, their race. So we've been playing with how to siphon out all of these different subjects that we could potentially cover, because it's so numerous. So at this point, it's kind of a crapshoot, honestly. Like, the lists are everywhere. I rely heavily on our staff to do their job. I'm always reminding them of our mission statement, because there is an overwhelming amount of drummers. So no, we don't have a list. We've attempted. I'm sure that if you spoke to one of our writers, they would say they're keeping a list or kept a list, but it's now, you know, like, how do you keep track of thousands and thousands of stories? You just right. kind of, the person gets lucky, they pitch you, someone pitches you, right timing, right place. Or you hear about someone, you go see their show, and it's just like, that's kind of how it happens these days.
Yeah. How important is being in New York to your magazine?
I think it's essential. I don't think that I don't think that I would have been able to have thought about this if I hadn't been here. Specifically, I was volunteering at something called Willie Mae Rock Camp for Girls, which had an equal amount of women teaching as it did students and campers. So I over the course of like the first, you know, 4 or 5 years of volunteering at that camp, met hundreds of women that were not only just playing drums, they were incredible at drums. They were teaching drums. So that was New York exclusive. Secondly, I was throwing shows in my house, in my loft, and I was touring all the time. And the music scene in Brooklyn was so vibrant and percolating. It still is. It's just like, kind of makes you think anything is possible. You can lose perspective on the rest of the country, the rest of the world. So I harnessed that optimistic, everything is possible for girls in music energy that I think was only available to me here in New York. Combining media and personality that's bursting out in New York too. And I think all of that and my feminism, all of that made it possible for me to imagine starting a company or magazine around girls and drums. I've tried to imagine where else I could live around the world to have come up with this. Some part of me thinks maybe London. Mm-hmm. If I was in London, there's just loads of musicians there. It's equally like pervasive, but yeah, it feels like the perfect storm.
Not even LA.
Not really LA.
Okay.
I very quickly integrated LA into our world and started traveling there. And I hadn't, but I did it for the magazine. And I've subsequently met and have connected with so many incredible drummers out there. I just think that the way that they build community is different. They obviously have to drive everywhere and their neighborhoods are kind of spread out. And so it wouldn't have been a no-brainer for me. I would have gone there and maybe not have thought about community as much, which here I think about community all the time. It's very easy to organize people here.
Well, it's, you don't have to, they can't drive very far without being stuck, so.
If no one's driving, they're riding their bikes, and I can get them to ride their bike somewhere and right. help me with something.
So. Or take the subway. I mean, yeah, it's just.
Yeah.
And everyone's in the same boat. That's the kind of the beauty of New York City.
Yeah, and I mean, magazines don't thrive today, and I think mine has lasted so long because of the kind of people that New Yorkers are, which is if we're passionate about something, we're going to make it happen.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know that that happens everywhere else.
With the magazine, how do you figure out a schedule of content? I mean, obviously you have plenty of content, you're not worried about that, but how do you plan out when things are going to come out?
So I rolled some dice early on, like literally in the beginning. And I was like, what's the least amount a magazine could print? And someone lied to me and said 4 times a year. You can actually print once a year or twice. But I said, okay, great. Then we're quarterly. So we are and have been a quarterly magazine, which means we put out a 76 full color print publication 4 times a year. And we always have themes around those issues. And usually the themes are there to challenge our staff to locate and cover drummers that we wouldn't otherwise know or think about or don't have. It's not our forte. So in the past, we've had issues themed around country music and orchestral music. We're doing a marching band issue. Mm. We have a gospel issue coming up. We just finished a DIY issue. We did a money issue. So we work on these sort of like narrower subjects to try to get to the meat of something. And outside of that, we have new content on our website every day, every other day. We have social media, we have events, and we organize our content there pretty much using our mission, like I said earlier, to funnel everything through. But obviously, everything online is more current. So it'll be like album reviews and music video releases and kind of fun lessons and things like that. And each one of our different, like our reviews editor kind of handles our review schedule and our web manager handles our web. And so each of we're compartmentalized now and everybody's on a roll with what they're working on and how that's evolving.
Tell me about the new podcast you recently started.
I've got a podcast. Mm-hmm. Tidal approached us, which is Jay-Z and Beyonce's music streaming company. Mm-hmm. They approached us to pitch a podcast. And so I used it as an opportunity to not speak exclusively to female drummers. There's lots of female drummers in the podcast, but also speak to some other heroes of mine and people who I believe are change makers and revolutionary in their own way. So I've spoken to Valerie Scroggins from ESG, Janet Weiss, Sleater Kinney, Fred Armisen from Portlandia and SNL, Andre Torres, who started Wax Poetic, and he is now at Atlantic, or sorry, he's now at Universal, and he started an Urban Legends collection there. So it's just like a nice space for me to be able to, I guess, showcase these people I've met through the magazine and just continue to talk about making change on large scale, intentionally and a little bit less intentionally. Gotcha. It's called The Beat and the Pulse.
Yes.
Right. That's what it's called, The Beat and the Pulse.
Yes.
You can listen to them at thebeatandthepulse.com or on Apple, you know, on the website. It leads you everywhere else, to Google Play and Apple and Tidal and everywhere.
Yeah. Are you enjoying that so far?
I am. It's like having a whole nother job.
Yep.
I'm really enjoying it. I would like to potentially transition it to being a live taping because that is exciting to me. I feed off energy a lot and also like feel like I'm like keeping the guests to myself, which doesn't seem fair. I'd like to let everyone kind of meet my guests because they're special and they're incredible. And I feel like they're, yeah, it would just be nice to have people hear me ask them questions.
Do you mean in the same space or just like a Facebook Live type?
I mean in a live venue scenario. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm still scared of that.
IRL.
So while you're doing all of these aspects for TomTom, what's your performance schedule like and where are you playing mostly? Is there one?
No.
Okay.
I don't even know when, but I started to realize probably 2-3 years in that I was going to have to pick a drum career or the magazine, and I picked the magazine because it felt much larger and I'd already done a drum thing, you know, like I'd already been in many, many bands. So I play for fun. I sometimes play in these larger museum performances that I put together, and sometimes I have ideas of what I'd want to do for a band, but it pushes me a bit less, like a little bit less compelled to be in a band and tour, and I'm way more compelled to put a media company together and grow the representation of girl drummers. Yeah. Can't explain exactly why, but it's taken over.
Yeah. No, with all the different arms that you've already talked about, I see it.
Yeah.
But tell me a little bit more about these museum pieces, because I was reading up about them and sounded pretty extraordinary. If they want to show up in mid-Missouri, you know.
Yeah, we'll come anywhere, basically. So the project is called The Oral History of Female Drummers, and I was given a chance to do it for the first time at MoMA PS1 in 2011. And I basically used this space. It's normally a quiet and contemplative space. It's a museum. It's always done in a museum or unexpected spaces like lobbies of hotels. But generally speaking, it's meant to be in a contemporary art space. The idea behind putting the drummers, obviously all of them are female, in a museum is there's so many. Firstly, women are often the subjects of the art, not necessarily the artists. of the paintings hanging in museums and were silenced on the, as these muses were just there to look at. But in this performance, the drummers are stationed all over the museum, away from each other, occupying space in terms of sound. So they're playing drums and it's filling the rooms that they're in. I have usually enlisted a beatboxer, and she takes the drum beats from each individual drummer and brings them to the next drummer, therefore telling their oral histories. So these drummers are set up all around the museum. They can't see or hear each other, which is a metaphor for us girl drummers in the first place before Tom Tom. Like, you would hear of another girl drummer, but you didn't know who she was. And there's the oral historian bringing one beat over to the next woman, to the next woman, to the next woman, until all of our beats are meshed together and we're telling one story together via these beats that the beatboxer at the very end of the performance beatboxes for everybody. It's really lovely, and it's obviously, it's like a deviation from the straightforward, like, here's an article about a drummer, she exists. This is like, great, come to this performance, find all the drummers in the museum, experience them, they're all incredible in their own ways, you know. Follow the beatboxer around, she's amazing, she's got a little amplifier, hear the story at the end, and maybe this, the reason why I run Tom Tom will become apparent at the end of it, for in another way, you know, in a less literal way. And then more recently, I did a version of this called Getting Louder. So the oral history of female drummers is getting louder. And at each performance time period throughout the day, the drummers played for longer and for louder until we were playing for 44 minutes at full volume in this contemporary art space in New Jersey. And that was really, really fun. There was a woman there who was so angry by the noise we were making that she graffitied the wall on the inside of the space. She graffitied the wall in giant black block paint, and it said, gone home due to noise. I have subsequently...
I'm sorry, what did it say?
It said, gone home due to noise.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
I then graffitied the wall of my apartment in reference to her, and now that piece of art is going to be sold at MoMA PS1 for the next year. So you can buy Went Home Due to All the Noise by me as any poster size you want at Art Book MoMA PS1 starting like next month, basically, for the next year. And it's just so interesting to me. It's like the navigation of what is art when I come to these museum spaces. I've done this at the Brooklyn Museum now, Perez Art Museum Miami. The curators are fascinated with this project, and they love it. But when we get there and we're actual drummers in their spaces next to masterpieces and vases and all kinds of things, there becomes a new conversation about the danger of the volume levels and whether or not this is art. So that's been a really interesting and fun part of the project.
Hold on a sec. These museum curators in modern art museums are sitting there going, wait, is this art?
Well, there's just this moment, and it's something that I love playing with. It's where a drummer is very aggressive, and she owns her space, and the drum set is acoustic, and it requires your physical, everything about the instrument is your energy coming out through it. And that is dangerous in a museum. Museums are quiet and everything is preserved in glass or some other like way, you know, and I think they truly enjoy challenging themselves, museums do, and therefore they invite this piece in. But once we're there, the problems start to, you know, like, oh, wait a minute, I didn't realize there was going to be 20 drummers in my museum. Yeah. Where are they going to go? Right. Even though we plan it out for months in advance, even like cross marking where the drummers are going to be in every room. We do walkthroughs. By the time we get there, I've noticed almost every single time something has come up, something has arisen. But of course the performances go off seamlessly. The museum goers love it, and it's talked about, and it's really, really exciting. And often they walk away with simply the notion of, wow, I didn't realize there was that many women drummers, which is funny because that's kind of the point of Tom Tom, but this project's obviously way more elaborate than that. It's about people who've had to tell their stories themselves, these oral historians, to keep them alive, or else no one's going to tell them, and then their histories disappear. So it's much deeper than, whoa, there's all these female drummers here. This is so cool. But the museum goers take away this like fantastical experience, and that's been really, everyone's been pleased at the end of it, except for that one woman who graffitied the wall.
Right.
Who went home.
Yeah. I feel like mission accomplished on that one.
I know. It was like, it's so fascinating because she's an artist too. I'm like, wow. Okay, cool. What does that mean? I've been thinking about it a lot.
When they're doing this, when you're doing these events, do you give any instruction to the drummers, or is it just because of the way you're explaining the passing along?
So what I have told the drummers, I wish there was a drummer responding right now, because I think they would like basically laugh and say, Mindy always says, do whatever we want to do, you know, be ourselves. So their general instruction for the majority of these performances is to play as if you're in your practice space. And often they're playing for an hour at a time. Mm-hmm. So I have most of the time ask my drummers to be as confident as they can possibly be, as if no one is there, and literally to feel zero pressure to interact with anyone. And when the beatboxer enters the room and starts to have a conversation with her, to just be open to it and jam. So you're drumming, she's beatboxing, you're jamming, you're listening, she's listening. Eventually she'll take away some of your beats and incorporate it into this history, and then she'll leave the room and it's back to just you playing the drums. And there's usually a little audience and you don't pay attention to them. So that's her instruction. It's very like easy, I think.
Yeah. Do some of them, are they like practicing and then do they start like getting very angry at themselves or messing something up? Does it get like that specific?
They have sets. 100%. You know, they have sets. Yeah. Which is like, you know, not really the intention, but also it's again, it's just really about their own stories and their own journeys. So if that's what they want to do, I had a drummer wear headphones during she was listening to a click track and just playing with herself. And I was like, oh, that's cool. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, everyone's just doing like kind of improv for about an hour in their own world, zoning out. And I think people just love it because they're usually in these grand spaces. I like to place them in really interesting rooms in the museums, acoustically and also visually, and unexpected places like at the bottom of stairwells. So it's just fun too. Yeah.
Have they ever played and then it's been so loud that like something has fallen off?
I wish.
No,
no, not yet. The Brooklyn Museum had like researchers going around and like testing decibel levels around the drummers and stuff.
Yeah.
That was cool. Just to see if one of the projects I want to do moving forward is I want to face a female drummer in front of a great masterpiece, something made by a man of a woman. And I want her to play just below the level of destruction of the piece. And just have people kind of stand around and watch.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, I mean, it's like, for me, that project would be bringing out the living versus the dead and the muse versus the doer or the artist, you know, and playing with that idea.
I'm picturing just what would all the variations on the scream seem like, just all these double pedal thrash metal.
Yeah.
Museum pieces you've done there was one in Miami, I think, and New York. Like, have they traveled a bunch or here and there?
They've traveled. They still want to travel. I'd love to do it in Lisbon. I'd love to do it in Tel Aviv. I'd love to do it in London. So there's a lot of opportunity for it moving forward, but there's so much going on with the magazine that sometimes that gets the back burner. But yeah, it's to me, it's more about the actual spaces. The Tate would be amazing. There's an incredible museum in Lisbon. So it's like, I'm kind of picturing the space is filled with all these drummers and mm-hmm. wanting to do them there.
Yeah. How often at these things do you get someone say, well, I had no idea there were so many girl drummers?
All the time.
Yeah.
it's just all the time.
What's your best stock, either snarky or non-snarky answer to that?
Good question. I don't have a great answer to that. I'm usually like, yeah, you should subscribe to the mag, or I say something like, there's a lot more of us than people know, usually I say.
Yeah.
I mean, it is, it's kind of sad to me because I'm still like, it's a decade later and I'm still hearing that a lot, you know, and it's also equally exciting. Okay, cool. This person learned something new today, but it's like, wow. Okay. Got a lot of work to do still.
What the things that I've thought about is for so long they're just whether they, women were pushed into, well, there's one like not playing percussion at all. So then there's like that first segment. And then there's the segment where if they get pushed into percussion, it's because they have a piano background and they play like a bunch of mallet instruments. And then there's the, they could play some drums, maybe they'll march, but nobody ever sees them in behind the drum set. Like there's all these different layers of ways in. If you kind of pieced some of that together over the years?
I mean, do you mean like the reason why there aren't more girl drummers? Kind of like the answer to that larger question. I seriously have like 35 hypotheses around why that could be. And I think I would start with socialization of girls, just generally speaking, globally. I think that playing the drums requires a lot of confidence and is a very physical instrument and requires like moving of bits and pieces around, changing your heads, using a key. I mean, it's so simple at the end of the day, but girls are not traditionally encouraged to tinker with stuff. They're definitely not encouraged to sit with their legs wide open, which you do at the drum set.
That's a good point.
or to be behind people. Girls are often pushed to the front and like, you know, they're placed on display. A drummer sits in the back and sits down. The physicality part, which I mentioned already, like it's a kind of a misconception, but not a full misconception. It can be though, but yeah, drummers are thought to be very physically strong, and lots of people think girls can't be physically strong or they can't be physically strong to play the drums. Both are obviously not true. All these things are just what I think is socialization and not actual biology, right? But there's a lot of ideas around what girls can and cannot do. And then after that, globally, there are like a lot of religious constrictions around girls playing music at all, mm-hmm. and girls playing drums. Yep. So we've covered enough stories, but are continuing to investigate where around the world and here in New York and in the United States, where and why girls are, their lives can be threatened. They could face rape threats. They could be excommunicated from families if they play drums. And I've heard these stories from women in Korea, women in America, women in Iran, like it's everywhere. Yeah. I think stories like that obviously don't just affect the woman who we end up getting to speak to. It affects a lot of us on a much larger level.
Right.
And then after that, there's what I think kind of going back to what you were talking about, which is girls are encouraged to be in marching bands, but then not really encouraged to be in a rock band or pursue the drum set in other ways later. I think that has to do with the idea of what it means to be in a band. So most people I think don't even want their sons to be in a band, but it would be unthinkable that their daughter would get in a van and travel the country on her own and be in a bar late at night playing a song and maybe drinking and then sleep on a floor in someone's house. Like that has so many levels of adventure and danger and autonomy and sexuality and all of these things that notoriously people have left girls out of.
Right.
And that has been like, I think one of the biggest drives for me is that I experienced all of that and it was so much fun, equally fun, I'm sure, for guys and girls both to do this, to go on tour and have a great time with your bandmates. So I'd love to debunk that for parents, but obviously that's pretty difficult. But I mean, there's so, like I said, I have like so many theories of why girls may not. Oh, and the last thing I'll bring up right now is the ergonomics, the actual like engineering of the drum set. When it was first made, I would put money on the fact that no one was thinking an 8-year-old girl would sit behind that drum set, because I have seen 8-year-old girls sit behind pretty much like a regular drum set, and she, her feet don't touch the ground, and everything looks so giant for her.
Yeah.
And that's, I mean, that stays true for like smaller bodied people, just generally speaking. It's mm-hmm. like a big thing. The body bag, which I call it, which is your hardware bag, is like 70 pounds usually. Yeah. It's all, at the end, all told, right? And right. who's carrying that? Yeah. Who is carrying that? So I think that like engineering wise or marketing wise around the drum set, we've like kind of excluded girls and women and smaller bodied people like there by design. So. Some of the reasons why I think there are less girl drummers out there.
Right. Are these things that you were originally thinking about and they've been, I guess, validated from your interviews or from talking to people, or were they things that have developed because you've been talking to people?
It was affirmed through the magazine. It was all of these things were things I was thinking about. So I had already been drumming for a long time and was frustrated myself from experiencing a lot of stupid comments and insecurities and feeling like I came to the drum set late. So I already had a lot of these ideas. I also taught girls to play drums. And I do talks in universities all the time. And for someone who's not a drummer, not a feminist, never thought about anything like this ever, I usually open the conversation with explaining why girls may not have an easier time or an easy time getting the drum set. And I generally have to do that just to lay down the groundwork for this is why I run a magazine called Tom Punk. Because if I started just assuming everybody understands why,
right,
I would lose about 75% of the room. So I first explain to them where we're at and why I think we're there. And I've always thought all of these things. And then I now am and have been interested in gathering data to support what I'm talking about. Where in the world girls are not allowed to play the drums. Yeah. And what kind of threats they face there. How many more girls have been playing in the last 10 years? Everyone always asks me that because I've been around for almost 10 years. So how have we had an effect on the landscape? And if so, how and where? But yeah, this is all data analysts who are going to need to help me with that.
You kind of just slipped in the drumming and feminism.
Did I just slip that in?
You did. But I know that that's not, that was intentional, I feel like. I want you though, but please, like, I want you to go more into that aspect of it.
Our tagline for the magazine has changed from a magazine about female drummers, which it was for about 8 years, to drummers, music, and feminism. That's our tagline now. And to break that down, we cover drummers, which includes producers, beat makers, beat matchers, throat singers, beatboxers, producers. I said producers, even DJs sometimes, and music. And the reason why we say drummers now is to encompass gender non-conforming individuals, so folks who are not identifying as female, and the occasional guy we put in the magazine. Music part is we are talking more about music in general, music journalism, generally speaking, how it affects musicians to be in the world today. And the last part is feminism, which has been the driving force of our magazine since the beginning. Obviously, we focus on girls and women and GNC now, but the word is in there to alert everyone that we are political leaning. We're going to be activists in how we tell our stories. We're going to consciously tell stories of people who we feel like have been left out. And so that word feminism sort of encompasses a lot of other things for us in the magazine that if we listed out would be a way too long tagline. But I think comes through once you get your hands on the magazine or have read or been at anything we've ever done. Like, our intentions are very clear and we put them forward consistently of what we're trying to do is much larger than run a drum magazine or even run a drum anything. We're trying to create a media company that changes the way stories are told about people.
What are the different, what would you put under the subheadings for, because you briefly referenced this, but what would go under the subheadings for the feminism part?
100% racism, classism, ageism, ableism. Within our mission, we make sure that we tell stories about a diverse range of people, starting with the obvious is it's not even diverse. We're going to cover girls and women and gender nonconforming people. So put that aside. These people are going to be racially diverse. They're going to be wealthy and they're going to be poor and everywhere in between. They're going to come from all over the world. They're going to be old and young. They're going to have different body types. They're going to be good at the drums. I'm using air quotes. Mm-hmm. And they're going to be excellent at the drums and they're going to be beginners at the drums. They're going to play lots of different styles on the drum set. And the definition of drum set is going to vary from tabla to congas to full drum kits as we know them to jazz kits to every kind of drum set. So we're basically just like expanding, but what I think is actually just being true to the definition of the word drummer. So being fair and talking about drums and music. I don't think it's very revolutionary, but it is very intentional. And I think that intentionality has gotten us this far because we have told stories about people who represent lots of other people who have never heard their story told. Mm-hmm. And that has made those people whose stories are now being told, all the people who relate to them and all the people who appreciate those people, very happy and finally have felt like they have a place to go to read news about music.
That's great. The aspect related to religion, again, has I'm going to assume that's come up like with a lot of different, particularly when you've looked, I assume outside of the United States, even inside, but in particular, you know, what have you come into contact with in that direction?
A lot of really interesting stories. All of those stories stick out to me as something that I would like to go deeper into. I feel like we could spend almost all of our time focusing on these girls and women who have had to stop playing or play in secret. That to me is very interesting and possibly a giant root of everything else, of why the rest of us have struggled at all, if at all. One story that fascinated me, and I'm still trying to get to the bottom of it because they've kind of disappeared off the internet, is I believe they're called the Random All-Stars. And they were a group out of the United Arab Emirates, and they won a Battle of the Bands. They're a group of teenage girls. And as soon as they won the Battle of the Bands, they got rape threats and death threats on social media. And a government official there issued a fatwa against them to stop playing for their own safety. So those girls no longer play music. And that's one example of like, just like a jaw dropping for me. Like, I can't believe that happened. It was a guitar, bass and drummer band. And they were wearing like full garb, you know, they're Muslim and they had like head covering and they were like late teens. And so I really just want to follow up with them and talk to them more about that and investigate that more. And I know that there's just like in the Middle East in general, it is very often difficult for women to play drums because they're literally not allowed to. There's also many parts of Africa where, again, women cannot touch a drum, where they will be harmed physically. There's also drum beats women are not allowed to play. And I actually built a performance around that at the Perez Art Museum in Miami. So in Miami, I did something called The First Beat. It involved 19 female drummers spread throughout the museum. And I was asked by Miami, by the curators in Miami, to create a performance that represented the community in Miami. Community in Miami is heavily Latin-based. And so I gathered a group of us together from down there, a group of drummers, and discussed what we want to do. And we decided to take a Haitian beat that was traditionally played by men, that women are not allowed to play, and reinterpret it and make it a beat that everybody could play. So it was called First Beat because it was the first time this beat was ever played in this way. And then we gifted that beat to the museum. But I happened to be fortunate enough to meet a group of women who were already pushing the boundaries of these Dominican and Haitian beats that were very loaded. And basically, you can trace it back, at least in that instance, you can trace it back to a ritual that starts with a ritual leader who almost always is male, and he plays these drum beats, and therefore a woman can't play it. So there's just these sort of institutionalized ways to keep women out of the arena of leadership. And then if leadership is related to music, music. And I think with other religions and other, like other Orthodox versions of Judaism, of Islam, I think generally speaking, women are thought to be hyper-sexual creatures and given the authority to sing or make music would be just way too overwhelming for a male audience. So in Orthodox Judaism, women are allowed to play music for other women exclusively, not to men. So I do happen to know a band we covered called Bulletproof Stockings, and now there's a new permutation of the band. They're an ultra-Orthodox band located in Brooklyn here. They play for women, ultra-Orthodox Jewish, Hasidic. They play for audiences of women only. And I had the drummer perform in the Brooklyn Museum performance with me. It was the first time her kids had ever seen her play, her boys. That was awesome for me. She was on a panel discussion about all of this in the middle of the day that I was moderating. And so, yeah, I'm just like, I mean, my dream would be to challenge every one of these rules and really get to the bottom of them and really break them down and kind of pull away all of the danger and the fear that I don't think is actually based in anything and get women to be able to express themselves musically. That's my ultimate dream.
Do you run into when you, again, I'm thinking more of these installations, do you run into women who come up to you and say, you know, I used to play the drums? Or, I've always wanted to do that. Do you get
that? More than I've always wanted to.
Okay.
I used to play the drums. Happens definitely. But more often, like 99% of the time, it's someone's like, oh man, I've always wanted to play the drums. Like, I wanted to when I was 15, and then this happened. Or, I've always wanted to. My boyfriend always played, you know. And then I say to them, they're usually like 50 or 60. And I say to them, or 30. I'm like, well, you know what? Now's today is the day. Like, I've got female drummer instructors. If you'd like, I can hook you up with drum schools that I know of, and you can also check out the tech section of our magazine and start to learn to play. Like, it's why not? So that happens a lot.
That's good. Do they actually take you up on it?
Yeah, they do. Oh, we have a resources section on our website, and it has instructors on there, and people are often going there. We even ran a drum academy for about a year. It's going really well here. Taught lots and lots and lots of folks how to play drums.
Before we get started, you said you grew up in Ohio and then Florida? Was that the...
I was born in Ohio.
Born in Ohio.
And then quickly my parents shuttled me off by the time I was one to South Florida, to Hollywood, went to school in North Miami. Grew up in basically in Hollywood, Florida, which no one knows that Florida has a Hollywood, but we do. And it was, you know, like their big marketing thing was to try to drive people to Hollywood, Florida, because Hollywood, California at the time was bumping. Mm-hmm. So like, we're Florida, we've got a Hollywood too. It's not the same, but.
Was there a good reason to go to Hollywood, Florida?
Well, for my father, so as I mentioned earlier, my family's Israeli.
Yes.
And so the weather in Ohio for them was like shocking. Snowy, and right. There's like, what is going on? So South Florida is hot and has a beach like Tel Aviv, so that worked. Mm-hmm. It's very international as well. That worked too. But my father was interested in new home development and land, and at the time and still, Florida was a thriving place for that. Mm-hmm. So he went down first, encouraged my mom's brother to come down, encouraged my mom's parents to come down, and now have like 45 of my family members are all down in South Florida. And I'm here, lone wolf, New York City, holding it down.
That's great. It's too bad we're not a video right now, as the dog is licking your entire face as we are.
I haven't seen her for 2 weeks, so this is what.
Oh, that's awesome.
We're having a love fest.
Yeah, no, that's great. Are you the only person, member of your family, who's in the arts?
No. Everyone is really creative in my family. My mom is a painter. Mm. So my mom actually is a part of my museum performances in that she paints the drumsticks and the drum heads. Ooh. That the drummers play on.
Sweet.
So she's the generation that I consider to be the one that was like quieted, and we play her drum heads and we chip away at this piece of work she made, and we modify it. We change it with our volume level and our playing. So my mom's a painter. She's been a painter my whole life, but she was an educator to get by, for us to survive. So she's super creative. My dad was an entrepreneur and also a weirdo and like constantly trying to make up new company ideas and stuff like that, new inventions. My oldest brother is very inventive and is like at the forefront of mixed reality right now. He started a company that's potentially going to change the way we compute in our lives.
Okay.
And my other brother is really, really, really smart, too smart for his own good. And then I've got cousins and uncles who are all like, they make wood clocks and they're business people and everyone's an entrepreneur and like everyone has a creative bone in their body. There's also lots of other musicians. My oldest brother's a musician. My cousin's a singer. We're very like furry family. I don't exactly know how to say it. Very, huh?
What, you said furry?
Very free.
Oh, free! I'm sorry.
Puppy's very furry. We're very free. And most of my family is Orthodox or conservative Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
And so you would maybe think, okay, this family's quite rigid, but they're not. Everyone's very, very open-minded and very, very creative.
I was thinking more hirsute. When did you first start drumming then?
So I started drumming when I was, I think, 19, 20 years old. Mm. I started obsessively finding drum sets. And I was living at the time in Gainesville, Florida.
Okay.
Getting a degree at University of Florida and just like gravitating like subconsciously to any drum set that was around. Until my best friend bought me my own drum set at 21 years old. And then she said, here's your drum set. This is your practice space. I'm your bandmate. So it was just like I went from having nothing to overnight having everything. Like she bought me a drum kit, set it up in her house, said that was my practice space, agreed to be my bandmate. And so that was the beginning of my drumming career, really.
Oh.
Yeah.
So
good best friend.
Before that point, what is the plan for you to do?
There isn't ever a plan. I should just be clear about that now. Okay. There's still not a plan.
Sure.
There was never a plan. I've always been very passionate about lots of things. So at the time, I was working at a bookstore. I was studying, I think, a combination of psychology and economics. I had zero plans. I ended up moving to New York on like a off chance right after school, with no plan. So there wasn't a plan. And, you know, drumming was just a thing I was doing that I loved. I had no plans to be a drummer. I just loved playing and made a point to be in a band all the time. And then I started throwing shows at my house. And I was doing sound for film. I got a master's in media with a focus in audio production so I can continue doing sound because I loved sound a lot. I really wanted to do radio before radio was cool. I was super into radio documentary. I wasn't very good at it, but I loved it. So yeah, there wasn't really a plan, and often there isn't a plan. I've told to this to rooms full of college kids, is that if you don't know what you want to do, find someone who's doing something that's very inspiring and help them do that until it strikes you, because there's no point in forcing yourself to figure it all out. It doesn't mean anything. And if someone's figured it out and you believe in what they're doing, join them, and then it'll happen one day. And that's what happened to me, is I was just plodding along, being creative in my hobbies and working day jobs, night jobs that were just like, okay, getting by, until I knew exactly what it was I wanted to do, which was this. And now a decade in, I'm like, all right, I'm open to what's next. You know, am I growing this into the next thing it needs to be? Am I putting it aside? Like, where is this? What's happening? I'm also really no plan.
Well, I mean, so when you're growing up, are you like, in music wise, I mean, if you're not playing, I mean, are you, their bands are like super into, I mean, this didn't come out of nowhere, right?
Or no, not at all. No, okay. I had been forced to take piano lessons, like a lot of us forced to do something when I was really little.
Yeah. Yeah.
My music taste was a lot, was heavily influenced by my father and my eldest brother, which was, my father's influence was like anything 60s and 50s related. And so I'm like, I'm still deeply in love with Paul Anka and the Beatles and all of that. Yeah. And my oldest brother was into Led Zeppelin, Metallica, and mm-hmm. that was being infused into my brain. And then I found my own niche in the music world when the coolest girl in my high school passed me a Bikini Kill tape. Mm. So it was just, it was, and then I was also always into hip hop. Mm. The turning point for music in me was high school, when it became my identity. I was a skater. I went to punk shows all the time. And Riot Girl was informing pretty much every one of my decisions. Mm-hmm. And that led me till now, where Riot Girl is still a huge part of my life. I mean, like every one of the things that I sang about then is still important to me today. And I played bass in high school. Mm. Just to try to be in a Riot Girl band, really. Yeah, that was it. I was forcing it, though. The drum set was just something that, like, literally, I, if it had feet, I would say it walked up to me and said, like, let's do this. And I was like, oh, right, okay, cool. Like, yeah, of course we're going to do this, you know? Like, I don't even remember thinking I need a drum set, you know? I just remember thinking, like, I'm playing, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
I'm the drum, you know, a floor tom walks up to you and says, you and the bass, I don't see it.
Yeah. Ditch the bass, yo.
Yeah.
that's kind of what happened. I was like, okay, yeah. I will. And I haven't turned back. I like don't have the desire to play any other instrument. Mm-hmm. I love the drum set. I mean, you can't see this right now, but I have three guitars hanging on my wall. Mm. And I play them. And I play other things too, but none of them get me excited. I just play them.
Yeah.
I don't want to write lyrics. I want to write drum beats. Mm-hmm. Like, here's a drum beat I wrote, everyone. Like, that I'm excited about. Everything else, I'm like, oh, yeah, I did. Yeah, don't worry about that. That's just a riff. Like, it doesn't, you know.
Yeah.
You could play it if you want, you know?
Were you... just thinking about kind of the other parts of your site, were you like big into either writing or reading?
I love reading. Writing is a painful process for me. I literally feel like I'm in pain when I try to write.
Okay.
I absolutely love speaking in public, which I've been doing since the beginning of the magazine. I'm not a photographer. I'm not an illustrator. I'm not a designer. These are all major things in making a magazine.
Yeah, yeah.
So I know how to make a magazine, which was also a very painful process for me. I cried a lot. But I know how to fully design a magazine. I mean, people could probably at this point say I'm a good designer, but I have zero interest in being a designer. I pride myself on knowing good designers. Mm-hmm. So I'm a people collector. I'm a story collector. I'm a people collector, and I like to inspire people and show them other people that are inspiring. Yeah. And kind of give people permission to do whatever it is they want to do. Because I feel like I've been given that permission through my upbringing and through my genetics or whatever, through the way I am. I know I can do what I want to do. And I see a lot of people that don't think that they can.
Yeah.
And I very much want, I think we'll be a healthy society if it's people doing what they want to do, contributing and how they want to contribute.
Yeah.
And I love, and like, I can only imagine a world with more music. It would be so much better.
Right. Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. I mean, you and I see that, I, you know, and your dog, I'm sure does too. I would imagine.
She's a singer actually.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, she is. She likes to howl. It's really sweet.
What were you, what kinds of things were you interested in reading? You said you're a big reader.
I'm still interested in reading, majority nonfiction.
Okay, like what?
Love stories about people.
Okay.
I subscribe to about 15 different magazines. I love the New Yorker, New York Magazine. I love reading like anything by Joan Didion, Gloria Steinem, obviously Life on the Road is something I've been reading lately. I'm trying to think what I have. I do read a lot of more recently, like business gurus, From Good to Great, for example, Dan Harris's books about meditation. I'm trying to think, like, I'm not really nailing some of my favorite people, but, What the Dog Saw.
Yeah. I like that one a lot.
Anything by Malcolm Gladwell, I love. So I'm really into people. I'm really into sociology, psychology, business, activism. So anything related to any of those things, I'm going to want to like sink my teeth into. And I get really excited about people's stories, people who have thought about something new and have changed the world because of it. Mm-hmm. It's really exciting to me. Yeah, I'm probably leaving out some like large literature gaps right now, like things that I love. I read the New York Times a lot. It feels like cheap to say you read magazines and newspapers, but the journalism in there is so good.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's like incredible.
Yeah.
And oftentimes they're authors of novels and their own autobiographies and things. But
yeah.
So I'm a reader more so than a writer, obviously. Like I said, writing gives me pain. But I think, you know, if I had like 17 lives to live, I would love to be a writer and a photographer and a designer, all of these things. Because I work so intimately with these people and I'm fascinated by their skills. And it's so much fun to tell people stories or to shoot them. It's also really fun to design people's work. And to illustrate is obviously really fun.
Yeah.
But what comes most naturally to me is connecting all those dots.
Yeah.
And delegating. I think a lot of women have a really hard time telling people what to do, and I don't. I just don't. I was the captain of my soccer team, and that plus being a drummer in a band, I think there's like something about realizing that this boss being bossy or whatever, I'm doing quotes again. Right. Is actually just bringing people together and making something happen. And I have a way of being bossy, I'd like to think, in a very, like, generous and for the benefit of the group at large way. I like to see stuff happen. And if I notice that 10 people are sharing a room with me and we all want the same thing, but no one's going to make it happen, I'm super happy to make that thing happen by just telling them, hey, I think what we all want to do is the same, am I right? Everyone's like, yeah. And I'm like, cool. All right. Well, how about in the next 10 minutes? Everyone's like, yep. Like, great. Who can do this? I can. Who can do this? I can. You know, I find that to be very easy to do. Excuse you.
Right on cue. You asked for singing.
I know.
And that's what you get. How long were you was your primary career drummer? Versus the
zero time was I ever a professional drummer.
Okay.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I never paid the bills from drumming.
Okay.
I was always a recreational drummer in a band. It wasn't until I started Tom Tom that I think I became visible in like a larger world, and then bigger artists like Theophilus London and Os Mutantes would ask me to be their drummer, which I could have been a gigging drummer, but at that point, my job was much bigger than that, which is running Tom Tom. So I said, thank you, but no thank you. And I still turn down lots and lots of really cool shit because I'm doing this thing that I think is more important.
Got it.
So yeah, I've always been a recreational drummer.
Okay.
When I started the magazine, I thought, I'm not the right person to do this. I'm not a professional drummer. I've never been to school for drumming. I can't even read music properly. I am like, what everyone, oh yeah, the imposter syndrome. I'm like, I'm the wrong person to do this.
Yeah.
It took me about 4 or 5 years. So like 5 years ago when I realized I'm the perfect person to do this. And I mean, I've grown into that idea. Obviously I created that idea, but why I think I'm the perfect person, obviously to run Tom Tom, I started Tom Tom, is because as an average drummer, someone who's never been to school, I'm as excited about the person starting out as I am about the person who's been studying for their whole life and can sit down with any jazz player, right? So I'm in the middle somewhere. I appreciate the process. I appreciate that I have a lot to learn and that I've learned a lot, that people can look up to me and I can look up to other people. I think it's a very good place for someone in my position as the publisher to be. If I was the very best and at the top of my game, I think I would probably end up looking down a lot of people. And I'm not sure if that's why some of the other drum magazines look and sound the way they do, but there's a chance that like once you reach a certain level and you can't see anyone else or something like that. And I'm like equally inspired by someone who's deciding tomorrow to take a drum lesson as I am by the Cindy Blackmans in the world. And so initially I thought that that was a setback. And that people were going to see through me and think I was this like fake drum magazine. But at the end of the day, I think that actually other people have been left out of the magazines. And that a journey of passion in the drums can be defined in so many different ways. The end of your career, the middle, the beginning, the hobbyist, the professional, the gigger, the forever band drummer, you know, like, a marching band player who doesn't get past marching band. I think that we're all drummers, you know,
yeah.
And we're worthy of having our stories be covered.
Just because you said this, does that mean that you have some general thoughts on other drum magazines?
I know. I just realized I threw some drum magazines under the bus. Recently, Modern Drummer threw us under the bus. Like a week ago, they put out this dumb editorial and threw us and Drum Magazine under the bus. And I think that I'm sure they've felt the heat from Tom Tom for a long time because right out the gate, I was very aggressive about why Tom Tom was. And back then, Tom Tom was because there was, I was always shoving this in people's faces that there was no coverage of girls in the other drum magazines. I was angry about it and I intended to start Tom Tom and then not have to do it. Because I thought the other drum magazines would catch on and they'd start putting girls in the magazine and I'd just be done. Wasn't looking to be doing this forever. And that didn't happen. And it continued to like make us grow stronger and more fire under us and all of that. And I think that Modern Drummer turned that into a vendetta. And Drum Magazine had been partnering with us on loads of things, including Hit Like a Girl and all kinds of things. And the other drum magazines also are friends of ours. And, you know, Drummer's Journal and Drumhead, they're all friends. So when I say that, I think I'm not being critical. I think I'm being observational. And so if I'm wrong, like, I apologize, but I have a feeling that the drum industry and its supporting media has for a very long time placed emphasis on the best. And they define best by the most schooling, the biggest career, the biggest drum fill, the most drums in your kit. And I define best by the most inspiring, the most untold, the most struggle, and maybe the most interesting, which is a totally different metric and is why we like often have a drummer on the cover that nobody has heard of.
Mm-hmm.
And that her career may last for 2 years, and that's okay.
Yeah.
We're not trying to discover people. Sometimes we do. I mean, we're also trying to do all of those things, but we also are not trying to do those things. So it's like, I think the emphasis has been on discovering the next new talent, and we do that a lot, but we are not doing it on purpose.
Yeah. If it's a byproduct, so be it.
And it's happened a lot. It has been a byproduct. Really motivated drummers find us, and they have since we started. And they join up with us because we are the only ones talking about girls, right? And then we happen to be their homes, and then they are sensational, mm-hmm. you know? So that's happened. Because, and I think that's how it's meant to be, we're all judgmental landscape. And ideally, we're inspiring each other. If we have something the other one doesn't, that will inspire them to aspire to be that way or to do their own version of that.
All right, so I finish up with random ask questions.
Woo!
You ready?
Yeah.
Cool.
Can't wait.
That's the kind of I want to get out of this segment. So this is not totally random, but what's an issue? Something maybe we haven't covered yet that is kind of most gets under your skin about your purview, we'll say, with the with the magazine or with drumming in general.
Well, my specific position is I deal with all the finances in the magazine. I just wish it was easier to gain the support of the drum industry and through marketing and sponsorships than it has been. And obviously, I don't exactly know why it's been as difficult as it's been. I've had to make up reasons, and I either wish I knew why it's been so difficult or that it could be less difficult, because I'd like for our company to grow and thrive in leaps and bounds, and we've been stunted along the way a lot.
Just guessing, is it only because I'm female? Like, what's the, like, I mean, is it just a gender issue?
I spent a lot of time just landing on that as the answer. And that's obviously very frustrating, and I don't want to victimize us. So sure. I then move on to, well, the industry doesn't have a lot of money, or they've known all of these other magazines for so long, and they're all such good friends that they don't want to take funding away from them. I understand that, you know, but I wish I actually knew, because I think it would help me feel calmer about where we are.
Yeah, I hear you. Good. All right, let's get to some more fun ones. Has anyone ever nailed an impression of you, and if so, how?
Sure they have. I haven't seen it. I'd like to. I mean, people make fun of me all the time, especially people work for me. They like are constantly making fun of me, and I enjoy it. I don't know if I have like that much of a distinct thing going that someone can make fun of me, but, or like nail my persona, but, people will often say, oh, that's a Mindy theory, or that's very Mindy of you. Mm. And I'm like, all right, I get that. I could see where you're coming from, but I haven't seen anyone do a version of it.
Oh, okay. No one's gone as you for Halloween is what you're saying.
That would be really fun. And no. Not that I know.
Taking applications for people to be Mindy for Halloween.
Yes, please. That'd be weird.
What is the most impractical item of clothing you own?
I own like a sequined, see-through, vintage, like falling apart, kind of circusy top. That I was like, I need this. This is gonna go with everything. And I'm so sad. So obvious. I haven't worn it yet. I'm like, no. Why? It's so cool. I love like old articles of clothing and old things in general that have all these stories. They don't make for very practical going out clothes in reality. They look great on a hanger though. Really good on a hanger.
So you'll go through your closet and go, man, that's a great top, and then just move it and then go to the thing you're actually going to wear.
I have tried it on several times. I'm like, could I tonight?
Yeah.
No, I can't actually. And my partner doesn't like it, so I'm like, oh, that's just like nail in the coffin for that outfit. I'm damn it. Because it's a risky thing that would need support. If I was wearing it out, I'd need to have someone standing next to me being like, you got this.
Yeah.
So, gotta find someone who loves it as much as me and helps me go out in it.
Yeah. Not the, I don't know that, who?
Yeah, like, Mindy? No, I didn't help her get dressed today. That is all her, you know?
What is a great movie and what is a terrible movie?
Oh. Okay. I love the Nina Simone documentary.
Oh, yeah.
I'm spacing out. It's something Miss Simone.
What happened, Miss Simone?
What happened, Miss Simone? I absolutely love music documentaries. Yeah. So I love hers. I love Bob Marley's. I love the Slint documentary, which is the Breadcrumb Trail. It's a music documentary. But I love most documentaries.
Have you ever seen the Michael Jackson from Motown to Off the Wall?
No.
Oh, my gosh. That's.
Is it great?
Oh, it's incredible. It's basically Michael Jackson from year 0 to 20.
Oh, my God. Can't wait.
It is incredible. It's one of the Spike Lee ones because he did one on Bad, which I haven't gotten to see.
Spike Lee's so good.
Yeah. And
yeah. Like films like that are so inspiring to me.
Yeah.
And also just so enlightening. You're like, you know, you've grown up loving these people, their mm-hmm. music. You sing their songs and then you get all this insight into their work. I also love 20 Feet from Stardom.
Oh, yeah.
Really good.
Yeah.
I'm probably equally excited about as many films as I'm equally like super bored by. I can't get into science fiction. I don't have that bone in my body.
Yeah.
Also have a lot of trouble with like action thrillers cause I'm a very empathetic person. And so I like literally think people are being stabbed on the screen. I'm like, and I can't watch if someone's being gored to death or whatever. I have to look away. So I miss half the film. There was a really great gory film though that came out last year. It was like a parody about black people's lives in relation to white people. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Get Out?
Yeah. That was really good. That was one of the few like bloodbath films I watched.
Yeah.
The way through. I love Moonlight.
Oh yeah.
I'm from Florida, so that one was like, you know.
Yeah.
Boys Don't Cry, that was not a documentary. So there you go. So neither was Moonlight or Get Up. Okay, so a bad film. Bad film.
Yes.
I probably walked out of it and tried to make myself not remember. I did see Mel Gibson's Passion of the Christ. It was so bad. I was raised Jewish, so I was like, wait, I don't know anything that's going on in the New Testament. But then also all the Jews in it were like the bad people. It's going to hurt me.
Yeah.
Like, I got to get out of here. It was just terrible storytelling. And it was all referential. You had to come to that movie being like a devout Christian and caring about, maybe that's obvious to everyone, but I was like, ooh, I want to see this like very contentious film and get anything out of it. And I didn't.
Yeah. Well, and if you have to particularly for your empathetic thing, you have to like someone just getting whipped in the back. Just you have to enjoy that.
I was like, why am I watching this?
Yeah.
So intense.
Yeah. What is a piece of pop culture, no matter how obscure, that you meet somebody and they say, oh, I like this, and you're like, oh, we're friends. Just immediately.
Cardi B. I'm like super into pop culture.
Okay.
That's the thing, is I'm a part of it.
Yeah.
I don't even have to listen to pop songs to know all the words to them. I don't exactly know how. It's like osmosis, or it's just blasting out of people's cars in Brooklyn and I'm just taking it all in.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kind of know what's happening in the pop culture world all the time. I've read 50 Shades of Grey. I was like super into the Hunger Games. Mm-hmm. I like table wine and like McDonald's. If the general public's into it, I'm into it. Like, I'm definitely like a drone. So I absolutely love Beyonce. I love Rihanna. And currently I'm like everyone else into Cardi B. So if someone said any reference to any one of her songs, I'd be like, we're friends. Like, you are my homie. We're in. Yeah.
Okay. That is definitely the first reference to table wine.
It's like, you know, they're like, I'm like, what kind of wine do you have? Like red. I'm like, I will have that.
Yeah.
Or I will like it. Thank you. But if they go any deeper than that, we've got a Malbec from Portugal, 1930. I'm like, do you have anything generic?
Yeah.
Like, what's the most generic thing you have?
Yeah.
Pretty much, I'm going to be happy with that.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I have all these, like, very specific tastes about things. But generally speaking, like, I would survive and thrive if all I had was, like, pop culture. I'd be fine. I would be really okay.
That's great. So basically, if someone's coming over to your place, you're like, an $8 bottle of red, you're like, great.
Oh my God, yeah. I'm much happier than if it's something pricey, because I'm like,
yeah.
Oof.
Yeah.
What's that going to be like?
Yeah.
I'm not sure about that. I heard they just pour a bunch of wines together to get that generic one. And I think that's what makes it taste so good. It's just like, it's everything. It's all the wines. What, how can you go wrong? Can't go wrong.
No. All right. What is your favorite Michael Jackson song?
Oh. I think the Billie Jean song, because it meant a way different thing to me when I was a kid. And then when I figured out what it meant, I was like, oh my God. Like, I felt so much cooler. So it just evolved, as I got older. Yeah.
It's a good choice. It's a good choice. I know you said you hadn't, you're a recreational drummer, as you've referred to yourself. But what is either the most bizarre, the funniest, or the strangest performance moment that involved you?
Wow, this is a great question. For one summer here in New York, there was this architecture firm that built swimming pools out of old and disused dumpsters.
Interesting.
And it was like a thing. It was like this, like, come swim in this crate, essentially. And my band at the time, befriended them and booked a show right to the right of the pool.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just so much fun. We played the show and then jumped into this like makeshift swimming pool.
Cool.
I'm sure there's like 1,000 of those though. So sorry, I just failed on the.
No, no.
At like, I don't know.
Your equipment didn't get splashed or anything?
Nothing got splashed. I think we were in bathing suits, which is always just like monumental. Playing outdoors for me was my pinnacle of my career. Anytime I was outside, I was like, this is the show. And then if you pair that with swimming, I'm like, okay, I won, because you just play and you're sweaty and you're hot, and
right.
Then you jump in a pool and you're in New York. That doesn't happen,
right?
Really, it's not gonna happen for you here, but it happened, and that was monumental.
That's awesome. All right, and lastly, what one piece of art, whether it's music, movies, books, podcasts, YouTube clips, visual art, theater, whatever, has impacted you the most recently?
Ooh. I'm really into podcasts these days. I really love Note to Self. Manoj Zamrati's like podcast about technology and turning off and stuff has been really fun. I loved Serial. True crime investigation. I mean, that's not new, but in case anyone hasn't listened to that, check that out. There's also a podcast called Startup, which is the guy who started Gimlet, tracked his process of getting investors and coming up with the plan to create a podcast media company.
Yeah.
Well, the first of its kind. And I find his transparency incredible, and it's been very helpful to listen to him make mistakes and make decisions and be very real about it. I would say those things, Note to Self, Startup, and Serial.
An enormous amount of thanks to Mindy for her time and for being a lot of fun to chat with. I look forward to keeping up with her as her career moves along. Please check out TomTomMag.com and listen to Mindy's new podcast, The Beat and the Pulse. This week's rave is BlacKkKlansman, Spike Lee's new movie starring John David Washington and Topher Grace, among others. I've talked about Spike Lee movies in the past here, notably the Michael Jackson documentary From Motown to Off the Wall and his seminal film Do the Right Thing. The essential story is true for BlacKkKlansman. John David Washington, son of Denzel Washington, plays a cop new to the Colorado Springs police force. While being subjugated to menial tasks and jobs for his police work, both as a rookie and being the only black man on the local force, he decides to call and leave a message with the chapter of the Ku Klux Klan, asking for more information, and he gets an audience. He convinces one of his fellow white cops, played by Adam Driver, to take on the in-person role that John David sets up over the phone. And all sorts of situations ensue to infiltrate the KKK. The film is marked by great performances across the board, including Topher Grace, who plays a young David Duke as the president of the Ku Klux Klan, and Laura Harrier as a local Black Student Union chapter president and John David's love interest. It's likely Spike's best non-documentary in many years. It's fun, it's interesting, it gets you angry, it includes lots of great music, and he hits you with lots of references to present-day political situations. He includes a major shot right at the end, presenting scenes from last year's disaster in Charlottesville and the resonance of that situation. A fine movie and well worth your time. Check out Black Klansman. And that's our show. Subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts and leave a comment and a rating. Find the show on SoundCloud, Stitcher, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Get all past episodes and show notes at the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast. You can contact me there on Instagram and Twitter at Pete Zambito or by email at petesperkpod@gmail.com, and I'll catch you next time. Until then.